Word on Today FM.
John Gibbons is here for our weekly Last Word of the Environment. Tell us, why is Greenpeace facing bankruptcy?
Good evening, Matt. Yeah, this arises out of North Dakota. A jury has ruled against Greenpeace in an action arising from protests against an oil pipeline that date back almost a decade, Matt, back to the 2016-2017 period, when there was a lot of objections, mostly, by the way, not so much by Greenpeace, but by Indigenous, as in Native Americans, who were objecting to this oil company ripping through their lands, many of which they would regard as sacred, to run their oil pipeline through the lands. And so that really is the gist of it. So this company called Energy Transfer, which will tell you it's not even a particularly well-known company, in this small state of North Dakota, went to the courts, to a small local court, where kind of outlandish claims of damage were made. The company claimed that between $265 million and $340 million in damages had arisen because of what they called Greenpeace's illegal involvement in this. And anyway, the jury then decided to treble that and award them $660 million in damages. Now, this obviously will be subject to appeal, but if this is upheld, that's the end of Greenpeace and 50 years of campaigning. It's gone. It's finished. And that's given the toxic...
Will we miss it?
I think so. I mean, we can't...
Are there not others who could just step in and do the same thing?
I mean, Greenpeace is probably the biggest, longest established, best organised. I mean, we probably wouldn't have a whale left in the sea, Matt, if it wasn't for the campaigning work of Greenpeace, which, of course, costs people, Greenpeace activists, their lives when the Rainbow Warrior, with an Irish woman, Grace O'Sullivan, was blown up by the French Secret Service in New Zealand, I think
yes,
it was.
Right.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, these are brave people who put themselves in harm's way to help either, in this case, whales, in the case we're talking about this afternoon, helping Indigenous peoples who have very little power to stand up to the bullying and hectoring of oil companies. Now, it's a new tactic. Sorry, it's not a new tactic. It's an enhanced tactic now of these companies, is to go after NGOs, to go after charities, to try to destroy them financially. There was a time when self-respecting companies wouldn't have done this because of the negative PR, but of course we live in very different times. And it is ironic as well, Matt, that the new Secretary of Health, I think it's called in the US, RFK, Fitzgerald Kennedy, he was actually one of the campaigners... with the protesters back in 1617. I know he flies on all sides of the fence. So it is a curious little quirk of history there. And I suppose many of your listeners will be aware of a tactic called a slap suit, which essentially are called strategic lawsuits. These are taken by companies. Often the purpose of them is to harass and to chill small organizations, often NGOs, often charities. And in the environmental sector, if they can't kill you outright, then the next thing they do is to launch lawsuits against you. The idea is to tie you up in court, to run up costing you millions to defend cases which may or may not have merit. And this particular case, as I said, taken in a small court, in a small town, in a small state. And bear in mind, you might say, well, why would a jury of just 9 people make a decision like this? Think of all the local jobs in the oil and gas business in North Dakota. Well, there's not much else going on. Also, lots of people locally working in law enforcement. And we know, and I remember reading about this protest almost a decade back, and half the local police force were either on the payroll of the energy company or very closely aligned with them. So you get the sense of a whole local community heavily financially invested in this oil company, and obviously very little sympathy for the Native Americans.
Okay, I want to move on to a claim about world oil and gas subsidies, how the industry is subsidised by governments around the world, because I think the headline is maybe a little bit misleading, John, when it says these subsidies are worth $7 trillion annually. I mean, yeah. That's not the money that's been transferred to oil and gas companies.
No, it isn't. In fact, the actual direct transfers is probably about 5% of that, which would take it down to somewhere of the order of about, what, $500 billion, something of that like.
Which is still significant.
It's very significant, but it's not $7 trillion. The $7 trillion, to my mind, Matt, is actually even more important. This is what governments and states don't charge fossil fuel companies for the environmental wreckage that their products, both the extraction of them, the transporting and the burning of them, cause. So this is the estimate from this Leibniz Center for European Economic Research. They estimate that the burning of fossil fuels is costing us, societies and governments worldwide, $7 trillion a year. And as I said, only 5% of that is in direct subsidies, which is where governments pay actually lower the prices of fossil fuels. The main cost is the damage being done and the infrastructural damage being done, and of course the climate damage being done by the burning of these fuels. And the particular study now, whether one agrees with it or not, they make the argument that if we tackle these implicit subsidies through proper taxation of fossil fuels, that rather than depressing economic activity, it could actually lead to a boost in economic welfare, they estimate globally, of up to 3.9%, with some countries, for example, China, India and Russia, actually getting huge bumps of up to a fifth in activity, because they say, for example, that taking away these subsidies and charging fossil fuel companies for the use and the damage of their products would give governments, Matt, an extra $2.5 trillion a year in income. And this is what so many governments around the country, or around the world, I should say, are missing, is reliable income. And of course, we have the issue here that, and it's kind of ironic, following from our last item, that fossil fuel companies are the world's biggest free riders.
Okay, tell us about the United Nations study of climate disasters in 2024. How many do they reckon there were?
Yeah, difficult to put a number on, but the big ones, if you like, that they estimate, we're looking at probably about 550 heat waves, floods, storms, droughts, and wildfires that were made, quote, significantly worse as a result of climate change. Now, that works out at about 10 a week. Now, to drill even deeper into those numbers, they reckon that every week in 2024...
Sorry, it's about 3 a week, isn't it? 151 unprecedented extreme weather events?
550...
There's 150 unprecedented.
There. Yeah, that's right. No, it is. That's correct. I'm coming to that. Okay. But it's 550 of these heat waves that have been amplified, or events that have been amplified by climate change. But of those, about 150 or 3 a week are what they classify, Matt, as unprecedented. These are events that have never occurred in that severity ever before. And that's 3 a week. 50 weeks of the year in 2024. We're looking at devastating heat waves in Japan, massive heat spikes in Western Australia, Iran.
The floods in Italy and Spain.
Deadly floods. We saw those, of course, in the Valencia region in Spain, I think it was about November of last year. We saw, again, devastating storms. And essentially, and we've said this so many times in this slot, what is happening here is very straightforward. This is basic physics. We're supercharging the atmosphere. We're pumping huge amounts of additional energy into the atmosphere. Now, we know, Matt, that last year, global surface temperatures, and by the way, surface temperature doesn't just mean the land. That means every square meter of the world's surface, including the surface of the oceans, the surface of the ice caps. The global surface temperature rose by 1.55 degrees last year.
Yeah, I know we had the impact in the last couple of months of Stormy Owen, but we tend to get away with it quite lightly, don't we, in Ireland, about comparison with the rest of the world. Maybe that's why a lot of people in Ireland aren't taking these issues maybe as seriously as they do elsewhere, because we get the impact of, and we get some of the effects, but it's a fraction of what's happening elsewhere.
That's right. I think somebody described the Irish climate as being a sort of a Goldilocks. We're in a sort of a Goldilocks zone here. Not too hot, not too cold. We're obviously the biggest influence on Irish weather systems are maritime. And what that means is, for example, back in 2022, British temperatures for the first time in recorded history breached 40 degrees centigrade in Britain. That was not supposed to be possible before the 2040s. It happened 3 years ago, and it will happen again in the next year or two. That didn't reach over to Ireland because of the maritime influence. We're out in the North Atlantic, and that has a huge moderating effect. But of course, the maritime influence, Matt, is of course, it's a knife that cuts both ways. That also puts us on the brunt of ever more dangerous Atlantic storms rolling in off the North Atlantic, and we're first in line. So I think our luck, if we can call it that, may be running out. We saw Storm Darren in December. 3 weeks later, Storm Éowyn. These are devastating, powerful storms. Éowyn had some of the highest wind speeds ever recorded on this island. And unfortunately, we're going to see more and more of these events.
I see France is preparing what it calls a survival manual for every household. And this brought back to mind something I remember from my childhood when we had a book like that in Ireland. And I always remember some of the things in it that even as a child, I laughed at it. That in the event of a nuclear bomb going off, don't look at the mushroom cloud or your eyes would get damaged. And to protect yourself against nuclear fallout, I think the advice advice was to take sheets from your beds and soak them in water and then hang them in front of the doors and the windows to stop any of the nuclear ash getting in.
Well, we're obviously of the same vintage, because that particular book, which predates us both, but it was actually issued by Irish Civil Defence in 1965. The book was
before
called Bos nu Baha, which means life or death. And it even came with a little hole punch in the corner. You're supposed to hang it up somewhere safe in the house. And as you said, some of the advice is hilarious.
To turn to in the event of a nuclear bomb going off.
Flash, I think if you have a bag, apparently, place it over your head. I thought, you know, the old joke about put your head between your legs and, you know, the rest of that one. To return to what the French are doing here, they're sending out a 20-page, what they call a survival manual, and this is to deal with what they describe as imminent threats, whether it's armed conflict, a health crisis, or indeed a natural disaster. And the idea here is, what do people do in the event of something unprecedented happening? Simple stuff. What happens when the lights go out? What happens when you have a major power cut and there's no sign of them coming back? So there's things, and again, these were slightly covered in that Bos nu Baha thing as well, where they talked about having your stock of food will be made up of tinned goods and other foods which require little or no cooking. And we won't go into the description of how you relieve yourself in the corner behind one of those damp sheets as well. But the French, what they're looking at here, The idea really...
Sorry, does that mean you had to keep the toilet lid shut in case the nuclear ash would come up through the toilet?
I probably will leave the proctological aspects of this to yourself, Matt. It's not my specialty. But what they're looking at here, and I think it's very much reflective of the zeitgeist of the moment, and that is, I think we're all increasingly aware that we live in extremely dangerous and unprecedented times. At least maybe going back to the height of the Cold War, it probably feels as dangerous now as it felt at any time during the most extreme moments of the Cold War. And I think what the French are doing, and I think the Irish authorities could take something from this, Matt, and that is, the best way in the event of an emergency is not to be caught again with your pants down, but to actually be prepared and to have, for example, the basic provisions in, to have a certain amount of things in. For example, their suggestion for the survival kit, they say it have at least 6 litres of water, a dozen tins of food, batteries and a torch, as well as basic medical supplies like paracetamol, saline solution. These are the basic things to get you through a pinch. And the problem with these things is, we often think about them after bad things have happened. It's too late. The time to plan is ahead of these events.
What about iodine tablets?
Funnily enough, they seem to have gone out of fashion. I think they came
they've already got out of date as well, the ones that we used to have.
I think that was an ill-advised interview with Marion Finucane back in 2002.
Joe Jacob was the junior minister.
God bless him. The poor man, I remember, he got so rattled that he made this sort of policy on the air. And I don't think the advice is certainly the French are not recommending iodine tablets, although, of course, they've got enough nuclear power plants. Never mind.
You're not against nuclear power plants.
Not against nuclear power plants. No, but I don't think that they're recommending iodine on this occasion.
John Gibbons, thank you very much for being with us here on The Last Word of Today FM.
The Last Word on Today FM.